Usually when you think about a public garden, there's this expectation of just absolute tranquility.
Right, like peace and quiet.
Exactly. You picture a place to maybe read a book or, I don't know, have a picnic or just escape the noise of the city. You walk in, you look at the landscaping, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I mean, it's designed as an escape from the complexities of the real world, a place where you can, literally just stop and smell roses.
But today, we're taking a deep dive into a space that completely flips that expectation on its head. Our mission today is to take you on a mental walk through the Heritage Garden at the Polish American Cultural Center. And this is located in Cleveland, Ohio.
Right.
We've combed through the Gardie's architectural blueprints, its core mission statement, and most importantly, the historical text and the visuals from 27 specific markers. And these markers form a circular walkway around the ground.
Which is such a unique setup.
It really is.
Yeah.
Because instead of just admiring the flowers, you're stepping into like a master class in human resilience. We're exploring a nation that established early human rights, literally shifted the center of the universe, was completely wiped off the world map for over a century, and somehow still survived.
Yeah, survived and thrived,
Right.
honestly.
Okay, let's unpack this. Oh,
Oh.
wait. No ellipses allowed. Let me restart that.
Okay.
Let's unpack this because the physical layout of this garden actually sets the stage for the entire journey, doesn't it?
It absolutely does, yeah. And what stands out immediately in the blueprints is the geometry. I mean, the designers specifically chose a circular walk.
Right, instead of just a straight path.
Exactly. Which is the perfect metaphor for history itself.
Yeah.
Because, history is almost never a straight line from point A to point B. It's a cycle. Patterns repeat, civilizations rise and fall, borders expand and collapse. But there's this enduring nature to cultural identity that just keeps looping back.
It's cyclical.
Yeah. When you walk this circle in Cleveland, you're physically embodying the cyclical survival of an entire nation.
I love that. But before any nation can build a grand garden, or a kingdom for that matter, it has to learn how to literally build a foundation on a swamp.
Very true.
And that brings us to the very beginning of this historical path, diving all the way back to 740 BC.
Yeah, so we're talking about the prehistoric Bronze and Iron Age here. This first marker on the walk highlights the Biskupin settlement.
And the details from the archaeological sources on this are just incredible. I mean, Biskupin was a fortified settlement of the Lusatian culture. And for those who might not know, the Lusatian culture was this massive network of Bronze Age societies spread all across Central Europe.
Right, a really significant group.
But what blew my mind was just how highly organized they were. You had 1,000 residents living in these timber log cabins, and there were exactly 106 dwellings subdivided into two rooms, housing 10 to 12 people each.
Which is pretty dense living for that era.
Totally. But the detail that really got me was their environmental engineering. They built this place near a lake, right on damp, boggy ground. So they laid down these wooden sidewalks along their 11 streets so people wouldn't have to wade through the muck.
It's remarkably practical engineering for, over 2.5 millennia ago. It really shows a sophisticated level of communal cooperation.
It's basically ancient urban planning. Think about it. It was like a 740 BC version of laying down those wooden pallets at a muddy music festival so people don't ruin their shoes.
Oh, that's a great way to visualize it.
They were already prioritizing infrastructure and community well-being long before any formal nation even existed.
And that deep-seated pragmatism, it carries forward beautifully into the formation of the state itself. If we look at how the Polish state was officially recognized, which was around 966 AD, it comes down to a deeply strategic move, the baptism of Poland.
Right.
Prince Misko, I accepted Christianity. But
Well,
the mechanism of why he did it is fascinating.
wait, I need to stop you there because the primary sources note that he dismissed his seven pagan wives
Seven of them, yeah.
just so he could marry the Bohemian princess Dobrava, who was a devout Christian.
Oh.
Yeah. So, I mean, was this really just a sudden spiritual awakening or was there an ulterior motive here?
Oh, it was a geopolitical masterstroke,
Yeah.
purely strategic. At that time, expanding Germanic empires to the West were using the spread of Christianity as a very convenient pretext for invasion.
I see.
The logic was basically, we aren't conquering you for your land, we're conquering you to save your pagan souls.
Wow.
Right. So by voluntarily Christianizing his nation, marrying Dobrava, and having the Pope recognize him directly as a rightful ruler, Misko effectively disarmed his biggest geopolitical threat with a baptismal font. He took away their excuse to invade.
Wow, so he basically weaponized religion for national security. That's wild. And that leads right into the coronation of Bolzhuaw Law the Brave in 1025 AD, who was the first actual king of Poland. He was a master military strategist who expanded the territory, but the historical text highlights a very specific, almost bizarre artifact from his reign, his coronation sword, the Sierbiec.
Yes, the legendary sword used in crowning ceremonies for almost all subsequent kings of Poland.
But the legend says the sword got chipped when Boleslaw hit it against the Golden Gate of Kiev during his capture of the city in 1018.
Right, that's the story.
Now, I know historians debate the exact timeline of that strike, but it really begs the question, why does a damaged, chipped piece of metal become the most sacred relic of a nation's story? I mean, wouldn't you want a perfect, pristine sword to represent your power?
Well, that's exactly the point, actually. A perfect sword is just a tool. It hasn't been tested.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, a chipped sword has a story. This raises an important point about how identity is actually forged. Physical objects, complete with their flaws and damages, they become the mythical glue that holds a national identity together. That chip proves you were there, you fought, you conquered, and you endured. The imperfection itself is the evidence of survival.
That makes a lot of sense. But keeping that survival streak going when family inheritance gets involved, well, that's a completely different story.
Oh, yeah.
Because the history pivots from establishing a mighty kingdom to the really messy reality of trying to hold it together. The sources detail a massive crisis in 1138 AD surrounding King Boleslaw III, Rymuth's incredibly tragic will.
Ah, the feudal fragmentation. Yeah, Boleslaw the Rhymeth was desperate to avoid a civil war among his sons after his death.
Okay, so I read this part of the source material, and it genuinely confused me. He wanted to prevent his sons from fighting, so his brilliant solution was to take his kingdom and slice up into separate provinces, giving a piece to each son.
Yep, that was the plan. How on earth did he think dividing his own country would prevent a war? I mean, that sounds like the worst possible idea.
It sounds totally counterintuitive today, for sure, but you have to understand his personal trauma and the logic of the time. Boleslaw himself had fought a brutal, bloody civil war against his own older half-brother, Zbigniew.
Oh.
A war that ended with Zbigniew being blinded and dying. Boleslaw was haunted by that. His logic was called the seniorate principle. He thought that if he gave each son their own territory to rule, but made the oldest son the High Duke with control over the capital city of Krakow, everyone would just stay in their lane and respect the hierarchy.
So it was a classic case of the best intentions creating the worst possible outcome.
Very much so.
It's like a parent trying to stop their kids from fighting over an inherited house by taking a chainsaw and chopping the house into literal separate rooms. It didn't prevent war at all. Human nature took over, and it caused a 200-year splintering of the country into rival warring duchies. Exactly. And, a divided country is basically an open invitation for an invasion. And the invaders that showed up next were terrifying.
The Tatars.
Yes, in 1241 AD, the hordes of Genghis Khan's grandson, Batu, swept into Europe. They overwhelmed Russia, they swept into Hungary, and they plundered southern Poland with this highly mobile, devastating form of cavalry warfare that European knights simply didn't know how to counter.
Now, the text mentions the Battle of Legnica, where the Polish Duke Henry the Pious gathered literally everyone he could find. I mean, miners, volunteer knights, even French Knights Templar who just happened to be around.
Yeah, real mixed bag.
But they were completely slaughtered. But out of this massive macro-level devastation, there's one visceral micro-level detail about the city of Krakow that I just cannot stop thinking about.
Ah, you're referring to the St. Mary's trumpet call, the Hegina Mariaki.
Yes, the legend goes that a lone sentry was up in the tower of St. Mary's Church. He spots the Tatar army approaching on the horizon and starts playing his trumpet to sound the alarm. And he manages to warn the city just in time so they can close the gates. But mid-note, a Tatar arrow shoots him right in the throat. And to this day, right now in modern Krakow, they still play that exact anthem live from the tower every single hour. And it stops abruptly right in the middle of the melody to honor him.
It's a stunning auditory monument, really. I mean, the history isn't just etched into the garden stones in Cleveland. It's literally echoing through the air in Poland centuries later.
It's so powerful.
But what is truly remarkable is how Poland rebuilt after that specific devastation, because they needed to revitalize their economy, their towns, and their population. And that economic necessity led to something truly groundbreaking in 1264 AD, which was the Statute of Kallis.
Right, issued by Boleslaw the Pious.
Yeah.
And it's explicitly called the General Charter of Jewish Liberties.
What's fascinating here is the sheer pragmatism combined with progressivism. While much of Western Europe was deep in the Dark Ages regarding religious tolerance.
Like actively persecuting people.
Exactly. Actively persecuting or expelling their Jewish populations. Poland went the exact opposite direction. They needed skilled merchants, artisans, and financiers to rebuild the country after the Tatar raids. So they created a document that functioned as one of the very first attempts at recognizing human rights in a modern legal context.
The specifics listed in the sources are wild for the 13th century. This wasn't just some vague, let's be nice to each other declaration. It laid out 36 specific legal mandates.
Very specific.
It stated that if a Christian sued a Jew, the Christian had to produce both a Christian and a Jewish witness for it to be valid in court. It mandated severe punishments for killing a Jew, it protected their synagogues, and it explicitly stated that Jewish people were allowed to purchase any items, touch bread, and handle food just like anyone else in the market.
Precisely. It officially made them servants of the treasury, which meant any attack on them was considered an attack on the royal treasury itself, offering them direct royal protection. It turned immigrants fleeing violence in Western Europe into a legally protected nation within a nation.
That kind of foundational stability, it really sets the stage for a massive leap forward, because just a few decades later, we get King Casimir III the Great. And the historical text famously notes that he found Poland of wood and left it of stone.
He was the ultimate reformer. He recognized that you can't just have legal rights. You need physical infrastructure.
Yeah.
So he built 53 massive new stone castles, fortified 27 entire towns, instituted a new tax code, and literally doubled the nation's territory.
But physical defense is just one piece of the puzzle, right?
Yeah.
You also need an intellectual defense. Stones don't build an empire, minds do.
Right.
So how did they fund the intellectual leap that came next? This brings us to 1364 AD and the founding of the University of Krakow.
Yeah, Casimir the Great recognized that his rapidly expanding economy required a highly educated populace to manage it. So he established a university with departments in Roman law, canon law, medicine, and liberal arts.
Here's where it gets really interesting for me, the funding for this university. The decree was financed entirely by the profits earned from the Velitzka salt mine monopoly.
Yep, salt money.
Think about that for a second. An entire university funded by salt. If you look at it through a modern lens, it's basically like an Ivy League school being endowed exclusively by a massive tech giant's server farms. I mean, salt was the tech boom currency of the Middle Ages. Without refrigeration, it preserved food, meaning it was crucial for armies and survival. It was pure liquid wealth.
That is a brilliant comparison. Salt was the economic engine of the era. And if we look at the legacy of that specific investment, that university went on to educate two massive figures on this timeline, centuries apart, but walking the exact same halls built by salt money.
I know this one. In the 15th century, they educated Nicholas Copernicus, the astronomer.
Okay.
And then way later, the 20th century, they educated Karol Wojtyla.
Who the world later knew as Pope John Paul II.
Right. The macro impact of that medieval salt mine money literally shaped the modern world.
It really did. But, you know, we have to remember that this era of intellectual growth was constantly shadowed by massive clashes of empires. The timeline highlights the Battle of Grunwald in 1410 AD. This was arguably the largest and bloodiest battle of medieval Europe.
The numbers in the sources are just staggering. You have King Ladislaw Agiello uniting Polish and Lithuanian forces.
Mm-hmm.
About 39,000 troops.
A huge army for that time.
Yeah. And they're going up against 27,000 forces of the Teutonic Order. But who exactly were the Teutonic Knights and why were they fighting?
Well, the Teutonic Order started as Germanic crusading knights, originally invited into the region decades prior to help Christianize pagan tribes. But over time, they essentially became a massive, heavily armored, expansionist corporate state. They were highly disciplined and incredibly threatening to the Polish-Lithuanian borders.
So how did an alliance of Poles and Lithuanians manage to crush such a disciplined, heavily armored force?
It was a tactical masterpiece of environmental warfare. Yeah. The battle took place in the heat of mid-July. King Jagiello purposely delayed the engagement, hiding his troops in the cool shade of the surrounding forests. He let the Teutonic Knights stand out in the open fields under the baking summer sun in heavy plate armor for hours.
Oh, wow.
By the time the actual combat started, the Teutonic Knights were exhausted and severely dehydrated. Jagiello's forces systematically outflanked them, eventually killing the Grand Master himself.
That is brutal, but brilliant. However, military glory seems to be incredibly fragile on this walk, because just 34 years later, in 1444, we hit a devastating pivot, the Battle of Varna. The young king of Poland and Hungary, Ladislaw III, is only 20 years old. He leads a vastly outnumbered Christian army against 50,000 Ottoman Turkish forces.
And against the desperate advice of his military commanders, the young king decided to take a wildly aggressive offensive stance. He charged the enemy lines and was slain in battle. The defeat wasn't just a loss for Poland, it was a catastrophic loss for all of Europe. By losing that army, it directly ended any hope of providing military assistance to the Byzantine Empire, which inevitably led to the fall of Constantinople to the Ottomans in 1453.
It's a dizzying pivot from strategic victory to absolute devastation. But amidst all this bloodshed, that Polish intellect we talked about earlier continues to shine. We mentioned him a moment ago, but in 1543, Nicholas Copernicus finally publishes De Revolutionibus.
The man who stopped the sun and moved the earth, he proposed the heliocentric model, placing the sun at the center of the universe rather than the earth.
But what the Garden's history emphasizes is that he was terrified. He was a true Renaissance man, a lawyer, a doctor, an architect, and even a soldier who commanded a fortress defense against those same Teutonic Knights. Yet, he feared repercussion from the Catholic Church so deeply that he kept the printing of his groundbreaking book a secret until he was literally on his deathbed. Why wait his entire life?
Because he fully understood the danger of upending the accepted paradigm of human existence. To say the earth was not the center of God's universe was bordering on heresy at the time. But his courage to finally publish it, even at the end of his life, laid the vital groundwork for Kepler, Galileo, and modern astronomy.
Well, speaking of shifting paradigms, Poland was about to dramatically shift its own political universe.
Yeah.
We arrive at 1569 AD and the Union of Lublin.
This is a monumental moment in political history. The declaration officially joined Poland and Lithuania into a single massive state, the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. But what makes it completely unique is how they governed it. It was a nobles' democracy, often called the Golden Liberty.
Right. The sources say they had an elected monarch working together with a Senate and a Parliament. Imagine a massive European power in the 16th century where the kings didn't just inherit the throne, they actually had to campaign and be elected by the nobility. It was an unprecedented system of liberty and religious tolerance in a continent otherwise dominated by absolute iron-fisted kings.
It sounds like a utopian golden age, but there's a dark side to that coin. If your governance relies on unanimous agreement and progressive ideals, but your neighbors are ruthless expansionist empires.
And ideals aren't enough.
Exactly. Ideals are not enough to defend your borders.
And that vulnerability becomes painfully, violently clear in 1655 with the event historically known as the Deluge. It was a Swedish invasion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have to push back here because when I think of Sweden today, I think of IKEA and neutrality, not ruthless pillagers. How devastating could they be?
Well, in the 17th century, the Swedish war machine was one of the most hardened, lethal forces in Europe, having just spent decades fighting the 30 Years' War. They essentially steamrolled the Commonwealth. They slaughtered populations, emptied churches, burned towns, and literally engaged in state-sponsored theft on a massive scale.
Wow.
Furniture, art, and entire libraries of books were packed onto wagons and shipped back across the Baltic Sea to Sweden. The Polish king, Jan Kazimierz, was even forced into exile.
That is wild. It's like a countrywide heist. But the turning point of this entire war centers on one specific location, the Jasnogóra Monastery in Częstochowa. It's the spiritual center of Poland, housing the sacred icon of the Black Madonna. A small, heroic group of monks and soldiers managed to hold off the Swedish siege there. The psychological impact of that defense was so massive that it sparked a nationwide counterattack. The king returned and officially consecrated the country to the protection of the Mother of God. They survived, but the Commonwealth lost a third of its population and permanently lost its great power status.
They were battered, but still breathing. However, this weakened state leads us directly into what might be the most heartbreaking paradox on this entire historical walk.
It really is. The timeline here honestly hurts my brain. We hit the late 1700s. 1776 to 1784, we have these two brilliant Polish heroes, Tadeusz Kościuszko, and Kazimierz Pulaski, who traveled to America.
Two towering figures who essentially bridged Polish and American history.
Exactly. Kościuszko is a brilliant military engineer who designed and built the defensive fortifications that secure the American victory at the Battle of Saratoga, widely considered the turning point of the American Revolutionary War. Meanwhile, Pulaski becomes known as the father of the American cavalry. He literally saves George Washington's life at the Battle of Brandywine and tragically dies from wounds suffered fighting at Savannah. These two men are in America, shedding blood to win independence and freedom for the United States. But at the exact same time, their own homeland is being systematically carved up and deleted from the map. How is that possible?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it is a tragic geopolitical collision. Back in Poland, brilliant reformers were trying desperately to save their declining commonwealth. In 1791, they achieved something incredible, the May 3rd Constitution. It was the first modern, codified constitution in all of Europe, predating the French by several months. They abolished the noble veto system that had paralyzed their parliament, and they introduced a hereditary throne to finally bring stability to the government.
It was a brilliant, modern, democratic reform. Hugo Kolettage, one of the co-authors, called it the last will and testament of the expiring country.
And he was tragically prophetic, because the surrounding absolute monarchies, Russia, Prussia, and Austria, did not invade Poland because it was weak. They invaded it because it was modernizing.
Wait, really?
Yes. They felt deeply threatened by a successful democratic constitutional republic sitting right on their borders. It might inspire their own subjects to revolt. So they committed what the historical text rightfully calls an act of political barbarism, the partitions.
By 1795, we see the third and final partition. Russian troops march into Warsaw. The Polish king is forced to abdicate at gunpoint. Foreign diplomats are ordered to pack up and leave. And just like that, with the stroke of a pen, the Kingdom of Poland and the Grand Duchy of Lithuania are wiped off the map. For 123 years, Poles became a people without a country.
Which forces us to ask a profound question. If your country no longer exists on a physical map, where does it exist?
It exists in the rebellion of its people. And that brings us to the 19th century on our walk, a period defined by desperate, bloody uprisings and the desperate search for a new home. The sources detail the November Uprising in 1830 and the January Uprising in 1863.
The November Uprising kicks off with this incredibly chaotic scene where young Polish military cadets attempt to assassinate the Russian Grand Duke Constantine.
And he only escapes by dressing up in women's clothing and slipping away. The rebels actually manage to dethrone the Russian Tsar as the King of Poland, but eventually the sheer crushing weight of the massive Russian imperial army overwhelms them. Thousands of Poles are chained and exiled to the frozen camps of Siberia.
And yet, they try again in 1863 with the January Uprising. This was a massive, sustained guerrilla war involving over 1,200 separate battles and skirmishes in the forests. And what is vital here is the return of the Kosynierzy, the scythe bearers.
Wait, scythe bearers? You mean peasants armed with farming scythes going up against the guns and cannons of the Russian Imperial Army? That sounds completely suicidal.
From a purely military standpoint, it was disastrous. They had originally appeared decades earlier during Kosko's insurrection, but their true power wasn't tactical, it was psychological. These were serfs and farmers taking the very tools they used to work the earth, modifying them into weapons, and choosing to die for a nation that technically didn't exist. It symbolized the ultimate peasant self-identification with the Polish national identity.
But when you can't win with a modified farm tool against a global empire, what do? You leave to keep your family alive. And that brings us to a fascinating piece of the text concerning the first Polish settlement in the United States. 1854, Panna Maria, Texas.
About 100 Polish families emigrated from the region of Silesia, which was then suffering under the oppression of the Prussian Empire.
I really want to highlight the deeply human element here. Imagine you're walking through this garden in Cleveland today, and you read this quote from a pioneer named Adolf Bankowski. He wrote, "What freedom did you have in Prussia? Didn't you have to work a great part only for the king? As soon as a boy grew up, they took him to the army for the defense of whom or what? Not your kingdom, but the Prussian one. It just strips away all the sweeping macro-level history and grounds it in the terrifying lived reality of a family just trying to keep their sons from being used as cannon fodder."
So these families pack up everything, sail across the ocean to Galveston, Texas, and march inland. And when they finally arrive at their destination, there is no infrastructure waiting for them. No food, no shelters, no supplies. Just tall grass, wild brush, and a few scattered trees.
But they survived. They gathered and held their very first mass on December 24th, 1854, under the canopy of a giant solitary oak tree. They pooled their money, bought 238 acres of Texas dirt, and they built homes, a church, and a post office. They essentially built a living piece of Poland right in the middle of the American frontier.
And back in partitioned Europe, a similar quiet realization was taking hold among the Polish people left behind. When the military uprisings repeatedly failed, they made a profound strategic pivot. They abandoned armed struggle and embraced a concept called organic work.
Meaning what, exactly?
Meaning they shifted all their energy into economic development, education, and cultural self-improvement. They formed secret schools to teach the Polish language, they built local businesses, and they preserved their art. They realized that a nation is not defined by the borders drawn by its enemies. A nation is its culture, its language, its economy, and its memory.
So what does this all mean? We started this conversation talking about the expectation of standing in a tranquil public garden in Cleveland, Ohio. But as you mentally walk this historic circular path with us, you realize this isn't just a place with some nice plants and stone benches. It is a highly curated physical space dedicated entirely to remembering a thousand-year fight for existence. We've gone from laying down muddy wooden sidewalks in Biskupin to a solitary oak tree sheltering refugees in Texas.
It is a profound physical reminder of the extreme fragility of human rights, the devastating cyclical impact of empires, and the absolute unyielding resilience of cultural identity.
It really is. I think if you actually walk this path, you walk away from that 27th marker fundamentally changed by the perspective it gives you on what it actually takes for people to survive.
And that leads to a final provocative thought I want to leave you with today. Think about the physical space around you right now. If your own life or your own community's history were to be summarized in a circular garden walk centuries from now, If your own life or your own community's history were to be summarized in a circular garden walk centuries from now, what would be written on your 27 markers? What are the wooden sidewalks you are laying down or the chipped swords you are forging today that will ultimately define your story when the maps inevitably change?